Hello, and welcome to the Doctrine of Fostering podcast. This week, I'm introducing to you the Good Friday special. My name is Jacob, and this episode, my dad, Scott, and myself spoke to Rhian Taylor. Rhian is the author of the book Foster Boy, and she is also a CAMHS mental health practitioner. Rhian tells us why she wrote the book, and I took part in the interview because I also wrote the book. I wanted to point out some spelling and grammar errors, but I also wanted to challenge Rhian a bit about some of the content. As I felt, whilst it was a great read, some of the way it was written was exactly how I felt living with a foster family. And I also had some other stuff to ask her. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast and our chat with Rhian. As my dad and I always say, if you want to leave a review on your podcast platform, please do so, especially if it is about this episode, as it will get up their noses. If you want to contact us, then you can do so on any of our social media platforms or by email, anfpodcast@gmail.com.
So tonight I am joined by two guests, and one is an author, Rhian Taylor. Hi, Rhian.
Hello. Hi. Nice to be here.
Thank you for coming. And you have written a book called Foster Boy, which is kind of a, well, we'll come to that in a minute, actually, because I need to introduce our other guest as well. Other interviewer, I would say. And this is very unusual, and we're all, well, this end of the table, we're very nervous. So I'm also joined by my son, Jacob.
Oh, hi.
Who's clearly quite nervous about doing this, even though he was up for it about an hour ago. But Jacob has joined us because he's read the book as well, the book Foster Boy. And he was really interested in it. So rather than me ask the questions on his behalf, I asked him whether he'd feel comfortable enough to come on, and he said yes, and clearly that's gone a bit wrong. But we'll get into that. So first of all, Rhian, introduce yourself and tell us who you are and about Foster Boy, really, to begin with.
Okay, so I'm a social worker. I've been a social worker for 25 years, I think. So working in a number of areas, mainly with teenagers, so young offenders, children in care leavers. I've also been an academic, so I was working in a university when I was writing Foster Boy. And I currently work in a CAMHS team, with a specialist team with looked after children. And I wrote Foster Boy. So, yeah. And it's really good to hear that Jacob's reading it, because I wrote the book for teenagers. It's a young adult book, but mainly the people who've been reading it are middle-aged women. So nothing again, I'm really grateful for everyone who reads Foster Boy. So all those middle-aged women, it's brilliant, but it's absolutely a delight for me to have Jacob here today, because he's kind of who I imagined. I wrote it for teenagers. Yeah. And the reason I kind of wrote it was a group of care, they were actually children in care, they weren't care leavers, said, "We're so fed up of Tracy Beaker."
Right. Okay.
So, because they were like, "Oh, in school, everyone just thinks it's like that because it's the main story in the public domain." So I thought about that. It's good to see Jacob's nodding there. You guys can't see it. But just the idea of a single story. And this idea that if there's only one story that people know about, then that's what we all refer to. There's a lovely TED talk by a writer called Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And she says she talks about the dangers of a single story. And she says, if we've just got one story out there, then we're more likely to have stereotypes. I mean, it might be that story is true, but the problem is there's just one. So if you're going through stuff, you don't know there's other stories. And in terms of the public, all they think about is that kind of one story they've heard about. And that's really hard for kids. That people don't have this variation of story. So that was part of my thinking.
Yeah. So I mean, I've admitted it to you that when you first sent us the book, I was kind of, it's not that I didn't want to read it, but I was, I guess after all this, I'm a little bit pessimistic about kind of stories. Yeah. But it was one of those books that, I guess the premise for me was that there's two sides to the story. So there's one of a family who are going to foster, and it's the daughter's story. But on the opposite side of that, you've then got the child that they are going to have placed with them as a foster child. And kind of the kind of story of how that all happens and how that works. For me, what struck me really from the beginning was that the Phoenix, who's the main character, who's the foster child, was, it just sounded true to life. It really did. And I guess having been a foster carer, and you know, Jacob won't mind me sharing because we've agreed where we're going with this. He came into our life as a foster child. I guess I didn't see myself as being that person or that family, if that makes sense. Yeah. And I think there's a different kind of range of families, and anybody who's interested obviously will can read the book and find out for themselves. But where did the kind of the class thing come from within the foster family? Was that kind of maybe embellished a little bit, or was that actually from experience?
Yeah, that's really important question actually. I think what I wanted to do, because it's a really middle class family, and I do worry about that because I know there's lots of diversity in foster families. And as a kind of professional in the field, I would like to be promoting that there's tons of diversity and, you know, there's room for everyone. But in terms of what I was interested in as a storyteller, because I'm also, as well as sort of being a professional, I wanted to tell a good story. Right. So I've kind of two roles really. And I was really interested in some of the kind of mental health issues which are happening for particularly kind of young women, particularly some of the kind of pressure issues, the class issues in middle class kind of areas in school. I live in Tunbridge Wells, which is a posh town in Kent, and so I see a lot of middle class parents, you know, and partly it's my own stuff that I get annoyed about in myself. So I wrote a family. I suppose you write what you know. I mean, we're not that family, but there's a bit of me, that annoying side of me that wants to push my kids and wants my kids to do well. Yeah. I was writing about that. So I suppose the class thing was intriguing to me because I was working with kids who were coming from really difficult situations. And then I was also living in this kind of quite middle class place. And I was interested in those two worlds and what would happen if you brought them together. So I suppose as a storyteller, I thought that'd be interesting. I quite like making fun of the middle classness. So I thought I could have a bit of fun there with the story. But it is interesting because I look back on that and I know it's a bit of a stereotype. But I also know as a social worker, there are some issues around money which aren't talked about that much.
Yeah.
And I know there are some complexities, and I think kids are really aware of it. Kids I know are really aware that there's differences in the family. So I suppose I wanted to bring something out in the open a little bit around some of the kind of stuff kids are dealing with. But I was aware of it as a stereotype, really. And I didn't want the middle class family to be the rescuing family. That was really important to me, that actually they learned tons. And they were miserable in their own way. I didn't want them to be the kind of, the heroes who were going to rescue the poor kids. I wanted to sort of take their family apart as well and see the kind of tricky stuff in that situation as well.
And Jacob, I want to ask you about that because did you kind of read that in the book? Did you read a class thing? Like, you know?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. What did you think? Like what kind of made you think that was there was kind of a difference in the class thing? Was it your experience or was it what you were reading?
Partially my experience, and like there's just the book where like you just get a sense of the poorness of Phoenix's family from the way that his life, and the way that when he goes home to his mum, being on the floor, the way that the room and the way that is described, just then, and then the way that the house is described by Phoenix, where the foster family's house is described by Phoenix, you can see the difference between the difference between the two places.
That's an interesting observation, I think.
Yeah, and he's able to sort of notice those differences because he's such a sharp kid, you know. He's able to, and he's able to see the kind of budgets for how social services will support his mum is really different to how they support the foster family. And the foster family were really wealthy to begin with. And I wasn't, you know, it's complicated, but I was also aware of some of the kind of resource issues around supporting families, particularly families who kids are going back to. I'd listened to this really amazing speaker at a conference, and she said her child who had been in foster care and then was coming back to her came back, and it happened to be another wealthy family. You know, these are not the only foster families there are, but he was going back to a family on benefits, and she talked about what that was like for her son. You know, teenager, aware of money, aware of possibilities, and aware of future. And I was really struck. It was a brilliant speaker talking about inequalities in kind of social services budgets. And if we don't support families, that inequality could get worse. So I was kind of aware of that as well. But I was also having fun, in some ways, just noticing class differences because I could see that. And also kids in school don't mix that much. I mean, I don't know if Jacob's experience, I live in an area where there's 11 plus. So, and there's really sort of, I know that sort of some of the kids, my children's friends just aren't having the kind of mix around class, which would be really constructive and helpful. And we've got things, you know, catchment areas, and I have quite a lot of fun making fun of that in the book, you know, but there's areas in my town where you can't buy a house for less than $500,000 for that school, you know, where's the mixing in that? So I was kind of aware of that division in society a bit, and I wanted to explore that.
And I think that's quite interesting if you think about it. It's quite inspiring for young people who may be placed in that kind of family where they can actually see what you can do with, if you aspire to be somebody, you know, similar to the kind of place that you're living in, I guess. But then I guess the other extreme of that is, you know, Phoenix's case, you know, he was obviously, and quite genuinely, went back to his birth mother and potentially didn't have the same opportunities as a result.
He says at one point, I could see the doors closing behind me.
Yeah.
You know, and he wanted to be there. That was far more important, but he also knew that there were chances in this family that wouldn't occur. In his own family, and that's a reality, and they're just they're really hard choices. But I think kids are more alert to the money issues than maybe I think it's a bit of a taboo in social services to not you know, to not kind of recognize some of those differences for kids, and that they'll see that it's hard to go back to live in a family on benefits if you've been living in quite a wealthy situation. That's actually not nothing. It's not the only thing, it's not the most important thing, but it's not nothing.
Yeah. You got a question, Jacob? You're shaking your head, you've got a list of questions. So the story is about Sasha, who is who's the youngest daughter of the foster family. And the foster family is a setup of mum and dad and three children. And what I thought was quite interesting as well was there was a mention of one of the brothers being gay as well, or bisexual, I think.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting from my perspective, is really interesting as well, because actually we're covering off these kind of areas that actually potentially within writing, you know, it's just kind of 2.4 family.
Yeah.
And that's a thing. So that was really interesting to read as well. And what else was, I'm conscious that I don't want to give the book away, but what was really interesting was that the children who are adults who didn't live in the house actually were more of an attraction to the foster child than the child who was in there.
Yeah.
That's surely just life, isn't it? You know, where when you don't have to spend so much time with somebody, you're attracted to them in
absolutely terms of, yeah. And that was the challenge for Sasha, that, you know, it was so hard, you know, it's really hard for her. She wanted to be good and she wanted to like Phoenix, but she couldn't stand him.
Yeah.
You know, and she says at one point, like, it's really, she wanted to be a nice person, like, you know, she wants to be good. And she's like, but it's really hard to be a nice person when there's this grumpy teenager living in the next room to you, you know. It's like, I remember someone saying to me once, it's easy to be like a very guru person said to me, or it's easy to be enlightened until your elderly mother moves in, you know. It's like, that's the reality, that's the nitty gritty of life, isn't it? You know, we can be idealistic and then we have to get on with, you know, you have, she had her whole space disrupted. So I was really interested in the voice of the person in the foster family, because again, it's a voice that's not heard very often, the birth child in the family. And I think it's probably a good experience and a bad experience. So I hope that covered both of those. But I think the important thing was to give that some kind of voice, because these are really important people. We talk about the network in my work at the moment with CAMHS. What's the network? How can we work with the network? But rarely do we think about the children in the family as part of that, the birth children. Yeah, I'm thinking, I don't know, this would be an interesting one for Jacob. Were they a big deal for you, Jacob? Can I ask you questions? That your older brothers, were they a really big deal of fitting into the family and those relationships?
I think so, because growing up as an only child, like, you always want another person there so that you can play with and share your emotions with and what you're feeling, your frustration, like your frustration towards your parents at that point, or if they've annoyed you, that you can go and talk to them and like say how you're feeling. But having siblings like in a foster family, I guess sometimes if it's like this, like the same gender, having an older brother, if you're like interested in football, you can talk to them about football and spend time with them playing sort of stuff like that. Whereas you think if there's a sister in that family, you're gonna go, oh well, I'm not gonna get that football like aspect of it and be able to play with them because it's a girl, because you've grown up most of your life with just being yourself and not spending time with other people.
And the kids were often more honest, I thought, even though they were more upfront about hating each other in the beginning. Actually, that kind of ambivalence that Sasha was acknowledging and Phoenix was acknowledging, you know, I hate this girl, you know, I've got nothing in common with her, I don't like her. And equally, Sasha was like, I can't, you know, I'm supposed to love this kid. I don't even like him. He's in my space all the time. But the kids were honest about it, and the adults struggled because they had to be the good foster carers. Yeah, they had to, there's a conversation with them about duty and love, you know, and the mum's been on the counselling course and she wants to do the therapeutic parenting, and she says you've got to love unconditionally and you've got to provide this space. She knew all the jargon, but actually the real kindness in the book was mainly between the siblings. Because Phoenix picked up on the kind of over professionalized annoying foster mother who'd done her courses and was wanting to prove herself as a brilliant foster carer, and he doesn't want pity. Oh, and that sort of way she sort of wanted him to talk about his feelings. He was just pissed off with that. So there was something a bit more real in the kids, the way the siblings, you know, and the foster child in that relationship, even though it was pretty flawed and difficult. And there was, but I think at the end of it was the more redeeming relationship. It was where the empathy really was. And Sasha in the end had to tell her mother, you know, don't do that for Phoenix. He won't want this birthday party. He won't want you to be fussing around him. She got him in the end.
Yeah.
And actually she was pretty kind in the end, the journey, and he was kind to her. And one of the other things I was really interested in is what I think probably is hard when you've got a foster child in the family, if you're the birth child, there's always this thing around comparative suffering, isn't there? You know, that we don't feel, if we've got a broken leg, we feel a bit rubbish because we know that there's kids dying of hunger. Do you know, but that broken leg still hurts. And I think that's a really interesting issue. So I was kind of, she says a lot, oh, I know my problems are only first world problems, because she could see that Phoenix was dealing with horrendous stuff.
Yeah.
You know, she kind of knew that intellectually. And I was interested in that as a problem. I think it's hard for us it's pretty hard to live with someone who's always got greater needs than you. I always moan about my husband because he runs a mental health charity and he always works harder than me and he's always got the more important job. And I get so pissed off with his charity because sometimes I want to be the one with the more demanding job and then the busier and the, you know, I want that attention. So I think this issue of comparative suffering is quite a complicated one. Mm. And the book was a bit like that, because I'd write these chapters for Sasha and I think, oh, this is a bit trivial, her stuff with her friends and her school. I almost judged her. When I look at the book, I think, oh, those chapters aren't really important because her stuff. But interestingly, that's what we do in life a bit. But of course, if you're a birth child in a family, that must be really hard because you still want your parents' attention and your stuff, you know, the social media stuff and the bullying she was having and the pressure she felt was actually pretty distressing.
And I think as well, from,
balance that.
From an adoptive parent perspective as well, you know, not having birth children, if I think about being a parent, and so as an example, myself and Jacob, the issues that I have with Jacob are probably very much first world problems compared to the problems that he has with me or with situations and things like that, because I haven't been what he's been through. But yet, as a parent, sometimes it can still be really hard, but I don't have that experience. So I guess it's really comparative, isn't it? So I think
it's that's tricky. Really good. I was just thinking in life generally, I think we're struggling with that. My daughter was telling me before, she said on YouTube now, everyone's the influencers kind of start with checking their privilege, which I think is a good thing. But it's this, we were all a bit confused about what to do when we know our life is generally really lucky, but we might be going through something. Yeah. Maybe that's a good thing. But I think sometimes the expectations, like, if our expectations of life are really high and events don't match up to it, that can make things feel worse. So I think Sasha felt she had to be good and she had to be nice. Mm. And all these expectations from this very sort of good, proper family, but actually made life pretty hard for her, because there was this big gap between her experience. So so I think it is worth sort of thinking about how it feels for when we're feeling bad ourselves, but someone else has got it worse, how we hold that tension. It's a tension, there's no answer to it.
Yeah. So I think Jacob has a question for you.
It's about the first.
He's going to quote specific pages, just so you know.
Okay. Wow.
The first line on page 17, it says, "Being put in foster care is like being an animal that's caught and locked in a cage in a zoo." I was just wondering, was that you like just thinking of a way to describe it, or if someone had said that directly to you, or had like how you came up with that like description of it?
I think I was just thinking of all the scrutiny being watched that people in care, children in care, have to do. And I was just trying to imagine what that felt like, to have everyone watching your behavior and commenting on it. And even private stuff, you know, stuff that when I was a teenager, I'd been so ashamed if people had looked at me in that kind of way. And I know we do our best as social workers to make decisions with people, and I hope we're doing better with this stuff. But I think from Phoenix's point of view, the most crucial bits of his life, his relationship with his mum, his most tender area, was the subject of kind of reports and scrutiny and questions. I mean, I don't know, can I ask you that question, Jacob? Has it ever felt like that to you? Do you think that's too extreme?
I don't think it's too extreme at all. I completely agree with that. Because my experience when I was in care was like there was always a new person coming to that foster family that I was in. There was always a new person, like they come, you get to know them, and then they go again. Like exactly like being in a zoo and being that animal, like that gorilla. Someone comes up and they look there at the glass, they start poking the glass, asking you questions, asking you all these different things, and then they just go. So like you're starting to open up to them, and then they just leave. So I completely agree with the description of that.
Thank you. Yeah.
You felt a connection with that.
Yeah.
That phrase.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And sometimes I think about kids in residentials and secure. It might be even more, for because even more staff are coming and going.
Yeah.
So it's sad to think that of what that might feel like for children.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Jacob.
That's all right.
Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away. It's very difficult not to, though, because it did really pull me in. That's the thing. I love books like this that pull you in. But it does go through a couple of months, doesn't it? And the kind of Phoenix does go through it's fair to say a little bit of a tricky patch where he doesn't want to engage with his mum, who don't want to say too much about this. It's really hard, actually. I didn't really think about sitting here talking about it because you don't want to tell the whole book. But
okay. I'm sure people won't remember.
Yeah, I'm sure. But clearly, his mother has a few issues, and he doesn't really want to engage with her while she's going through some of those issues again. And I guess what struck me was that is kind of a real true story. And was that based on what you know from your professional kind of capacity? You know, birth parents who do struggle and who do go through these kind of scenarios that, you know, potentially have to work through.
Well, I think it's probably not giving too much away to say the mum's in rehab, so she's dealing with a drug problem, I brought different aspects of people I've worked through over the years and been inspired by. I suppose they all combined a bit, so it was a combination of stories for me. I wanted to write about that relationship between Phoenix and his mum as a tender one, because it's another area I think that people stereotype. I mean, social workers as well, because they get very tired of working. You know, it's hard work to keep believing in parents and keep doing this work. And sometimes we can miss the kind of love between the mother and Phoenix. And all I wanted to do was write it as a tender kind of relationship where, even during these periods where she tremendously let him down, and there were points where he did build up a bit of a wall against her and didn't want to see her because he was very low himself and he was aware of that. But I wanted to write it as a love relationship between a mother and a son, even though it's flawed. And I think we struggle with that, don't we? We wanted things either to be all fantastic in families, romanticized and lovely, or terrible, you know, the toxic trio they talk about with parents, sort of language which sort of is a little bit dehumanizing, rather than just the agony of knowing you can't get it right for your son, and the agony for Phoenix of knowing. And he really believed, he absolutely knew his mum loved him, but he could see she let him down as well.
Yeah.
So I was just trying to see if I could write that in a tender way, because I wanted not to get into the stereotypes of bad mum.
Yeah. And
I wanted to show that you love, you know, that love, it's just really complicated loving people. And actually it is in all bits of life. Yeah, it's just in other bits of life we can easily pretend that it's not complicated. We can romanticize, can't we?
Yeah. And I think that for me, that was kind of a really interesting piece of writing, actually, because throughout the whole book, you can tell that there is mutual love between mother and son. It's just circumstances, addiction, you know, all those kind of things that we read about, not necessarily within our own lives, but certainly within our children who are in the care system or who are adopted, who the experiences. And I think it kind of clarified for me that actually there's just something else on the sidelines. Sometimes it just takes over and you know, we can help, we can do what we want. But sometimes it just takes that little bit longer than kind of society wants to be able to help our children who may be suffering, you know, within these kind of environments.
And one of the things that sort of saddens me is I did give the mum goes to rehab, and someone was telling me the other day that they hadn't known any parents who'd got access to rehab. That actually it's really unusual. So yeah. I mean, like. You know, that fact she had a chance to sort of address some of the difficulties. So that's a really worrying thing in terms of parents, isn't it? You know, that they're not getting access to the help they need.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to write her. She really, you know, I wanted to write this loving relate. And you could see that in Phoenix, because Phoenix had some good bits of attachment as well as, you know, as some really disastrous periods of neglect. Yeah. But the love, and you could see that in the ways he could function well in certain ways. You know, there were ways he was struggling and ways he was functioning really well, yeah, or was trying to function well. He's a really great kid. Yeah. I kind of love him a bit. I'm a bit fond of him.
I have to say, I was very fond of him, actually. And I don't know if that's just my experience, but, you know, he did come across as kind of a lovable young man who you just want to kind of, you know, just acknowledge for being a human being, really. You know, so I think he was written so well, yeah. Jacob, you're itching.
I'm not
make comments, ask anything. Questions, go on. This is a three-way interview, three-way discussion.
I was just thinking about the whole, like, mum going to rehab and him going back to see her, and you said that I was scared, even though it was my own mother I was visiting. It was always like this when you're in care. I was just wondering, like, whether it's, well, the same as the last question, really, if that was from an experience of someone telling you that, or if it was the same as the last time. Because I know for a fact, when I went to go see my mum, I know I didn't feel like that, because I was very close to my mum. Me and my mum were very close, and I loved spending time with her. So I know this for me is the complete opposite. Because yeah, I was happy to go see that, and I think it was kind of a release for me. I could talk to her about, like, stuff that I didn't really want to talk to, like, my brothers about, because I know, yeah, that if I say something that's really mean towards, like, dad and daddy, that they're going to end up going and say it to them. So it was like it was a thing for me. I could go talk to her and, you know, explain stuff to her.
Oh, that's good to hear, because I think it's really important, recognizing that, you know, the strength of those relationships. Again, in that situation, I think Phoenix generally really liked seeing his mum. He all the time wanted to go back to her, but I think he found it hard to see her when she was in rehab because she was incredibly low, and he was really close to her, so he picked up on those feelings. So I think that period where he didn't want to go and see her was actually, if he'd have been able to walk down the park with her and the dog, he'd have been absolutely in a relaxed way. But that kind of sense as well, that he didn't like being taken by the foster carer, he was going to be questioned afterwards. It's like a really false setup. And what I was thinking of is those, you know, they're not just stories, they happen. You know, people having Christmas Day in motorway service stations, supervised contact. Again, it goes back to that comment about being in a zoo, doesn't it? Kids who can't just, like you've described, just be relaxed and just meet a parent in a normal way. So I think normally, I was sort of thinking about those kind of sort of slightly fake visits that had to happen, and also just how sad it was for him to see his mum when she was in that particular sort of place in rehab where she was just very low, very tearful, very depressed. And at the same time, he loved her, but he was still an 11-year-old boy. And what you do when your mum's crying and weeping over you and saying she's failed you, I mean, it's still embarrassing, isn't it? Yeah, so there was also that bit of him that was just incredibly sad, I think, during those rehab visits.
I love what you're saying about that, because, like, when I used to go see my mum, you know, it's in a room and people are taking you there, and then they're always watching you, making just seeing what's happening, yeah, and stuff. It'd be so much better if you could, like, go out with them and walk with them and talk with them and just spend time where you're not, like, where you're not feeling like you're trapped in a room, and you it's mandatory for you to spend that time with them, and then people, like, you having a set time of people saying, all right, your time's up, you go. It's a bit like a jail sentence, you know, you go in there, but it's a good jail sentence in a way, because you get to go see them, but then you there's a set time for when you're going to leave, so you know there's not that sense of being able to spend loads of time with them.
Yeah.
That's a really good description of the problems with how contact's seen, and just the word contact, isn't it? It's a rubbish word, isn't it? I mean, it's awful, but it's still what we talk. It's what still what is professionally talked about.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and I know that, you know. I feel like Jacob, you've kind of not hijacked, but you've taken over tonight, because I think your voice is so important in this, because
you are
the voice of Phoenix in some ways. And I think that's what's important. You know, as a podcast, we're trying to kind of challenge the phrase, the umbrella of contact, in a lot of ways. And you know, Al and I have such massive opinions on what the potential is of contact, and it is an umbrella term. And you know, you've just described it, Jacob, in such a way that I can't even consider from my childhood what it would have been like to say you've got an hour or an hour and a half to spend with your parent. You know, that in itself is just ridiculous. Doesn't matter what they've done, or you know what their issue is, whether it's mental health or whether it's addiction or whatever, to say you've got 90 minutes to spend with this person who actually you know has given you life,
and that's the fact just that you've spent most of your life with them, so it's not any different to when you were with them.
No, you're right. You
it's quite inhumane in ways, isn't it? Because it's just not how we as humans relate, do we? And I'm really struck by Jacob's voice as well, because like what I've always said about Foster Boy is I only wrote it because there's not enough stories, and what I want, and for me it's just one story in my imagination, which is nothing compared to the voices of people who've lived it. I just feel conscious of that all the time, that what actually the interesting stories are, those are the stories out there. They're already there. They're in Jacob. They're there. But it's how we get them in the public domain.
Yes.
And I'm really interested in that. I've been thinking a lot about that. Mm. How do we get these stories into the domain, so we move away from this single story of Tracy Beaker? Or actually, sometimes it's negative stories, isn't it? These stories of deficit, or your the statistics, all these numbers, rather than having these stories that will actually make people aware, give them facts and give them awareness of what kids are going through. But also so it'll help people become more empathic, because we'll only change things in a sense we change things through stories, really, quite a lot, because that changes how we feel rather than statistics. So I'm really a believer in stories.
And I think I am as well, and I think that, you know, when Jacob's ready and willing that I encourage that story to come out for you. I'm not telling you to do anything, mate.
You've got to write a book.
But you know, your experiences would help so many people, and that's the thing, isn't it? But you know, your brother's story would help other people. You know, that's the thing, the voice of children and young people who've been through the system, these experiences, you know, it's really a key part. And I think that's what I loved, because whilst you've written it from your experience of dealing with these children and these families, actually it's, you know, I'm not going to lie, it just rung true, and it clearly rung
bang
true.
On.
Yeah, it rung true to Jacob as well. So, you know, but until we can hear other people's voices, and I think that would be my key message from this book, and from, you know, Jacob reading it as well. You know, anybody who wants to share their story, their experience, whether it be in writing or verbally, you know, we need to hear it. We need to hear what your experience is, so we can right wrongs and we can do things better.
We really do. You're absolutely right, and your podcast is a bit of that, because you have people's stories, so you also need a pat on the back for doing it. But the more stories we can get out, but I do think we need to challenge the publishing industry a little bit. Mm.
Yeah.
Well, actually quite a lot. I mean, the publishing, I think the publishing industry is changing because they've realized they've been white, London, heterosexual, and they've realized they've got that now. So they are really keen to be more diverse. But at the same time, I'm really aware of it's hard to write a book. And I felt really vulnerable. And at the time I wrote this, I was a university lecturer, and I was getting loads of rejections from the agents and stuff, which is okay, you know, that's what you expect when you write a book. But I still found it really hard. And, you know, I was thinking, oh, I'm not clever enough. Do you know, you hear about J.K. Rowling having a rejection, you know, 10 rejections, you know, and there's a success story. There's always a like, and then I had the letter. But actually, I realized just how vulnerable it makes you feel. And because I did really care about Phoenix's story, people rejecting it, actually, I was like, oh, this kind of
personal,
hurts.
Wasn't it? It's personal. Yeah.
Yeah. But I was also aware of my privilege because I was writing it mid-40s. You know, I had a part-time job. I was secure. I wasn't expecting to earn any money from it. I wasn't waiting. You know, I didn't need to sell them to make, you know, to feed my kids, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was aware I was in this privileged position working in what is considered to be quite a high status job. And I was still, it still made me very vulnerable writing the book, putting it out. And it's made me think a lot about what would that feel if that was your story. So I really think the publishing industry is really interested in diversity, but it would be lovely if there was more kind of proactivity in making it easier for people to write books.
Yeah,
I'm completely.
Does that make sense? I'm just saying I was in a privileged position, and whilst I really cared about it, it wasn't my story. And I think it would be even make you feel even more vulnerable if it was your story.
Yeah.
And you were going through those kind of rejections. Having said that, people really need to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I hope the publishing industry can get a bit kinder maybe and think of some schemes where people could be paid to write books.
Yeah.
Rather than kind of write the book, cross your fingers, hope that maybe 3 years down the line you might get some money for it. Because actually that will mean it's more actually diverse, because they talk about diversity a lot, but their systems actually a setup more for privileged people who can afford to do this stuff.
What were you going to say, Jacob?
Oh no, I was just thinking about like saying that we really do need to push the publishing industry to have like more diverse families in them, with like families in care, even though you don't have to go into the depth of that care system in the book. Like you can still have the book about what you want to have it about, but still like introduce the fact that not all families are, you know, just like mum, dad, and then birth kids. And I think it'd just be really good, and it'd make me more inclined to read, and probably make a lot more teenagers and people going through the care system more inclined to read, because there's other experiences, other people's experiences of what they're going through, and to help give you an understanding of what you might end up going through, or to help you go through those situations.
I think that's so important. And where are the just normal books with care experienced people just as part of it? Like you say, or families who adopt.
Yeah.
And I would have thought as an adoptive parent, as a gay adoptive parent, there must be a sort of sense of the single story as well for that as well.
You would think, wouldn't you? You would think, Rian. But I'm gonna name drop now, but Steve at JKP, he approaches everybody else, but he never approaches me, and I don't know what the problem is, because you know, I have a story to tell. It's all written, it's in blogs, so
yeah. Brought together. Yeah.
And you know, I think that it's a really, really interesting thought on that from both of you, actually, because I hadn't thought about it. So thank you to you both for pointing out.
You should both write books.
Yeah, I know.
I tried to write one, but I just gave up.
Jacob is very good at writing. He does give up, but actually he's very good in his descriptions, and you know, it's a pleasure to read, actually, especially when I find him when I'm cleaning his bedroom out and he doesn't know that I'm having a little sneaky peek.
That is brilliant, though. Seriously. I mean, I wrote this book. I hadn't written anything since school, any fiction since school. Yeah. And like I was 46 or whatever. And I decided to write 1,000 words a day for 60 days because I thought that was I thought that's just about long enough for a young adult's novel. And I hadn't done anything in between in terms of fiction. And I just wrote it from my gut, really. And normally I'm a bit controlly, and I'd have read 10 books or watched 20 TED Talks on how to write a book. And I just wrote it from my heart, really.
Yeah.
It was a little bit, I was working as an academic at the, there was a little bit of a rebellion against academia and being in a university, because we were teaching social workers and it was all about the head, you know, like being analytical and reading the research. And there was a bit of me that thought, do you know, where are the stories? Because stories change things. They make you, they can do the neuroscience now. So they can see the bits of your brain light up in terms of empathy and how you connect with people. So I realized really that people would learn through stories as much as they were learning through these, you know, research papers and textbooks. Mm-hmm. So it was my sort of slight rebellion against the life of the intellect, the life of the head, that made me just think, do you know, I'm going to write a book for teenagers and try and connect with something in me, which was more of a kind of heart response than trying to be clever about things.
Yeah. So my opinion on the book is, if you've not got it, you need to buy it. That's my opinion. Jacob, I'm not putting you on the spot, but I would like to ask you, how would you summarise the book and why should people buy it?
People should buy it because it gives them an understanding of what other people are going through, mm-hmm. you know, because everyone has their own like perception of how other people's lives are and what they think is happening in other people's lives. Whereas this gives you like, I mean, it's not, as it says in the first line, it's fiction, but it helps you to slightly understand what is going on in those other people's lives. And I absolutely love this book. It's great, and I really relate to Phoenix as a character. He just reminds me of me, you know, just blowing up at the slightest things, getting really angry, but then, you know, and just, it's just an all-round really good book.
Well, I think that's...
Thank you, guys.
I should tell it.
You're lovely.
There's no money changed hands. Nope. He is quite welcome. before I leave you, I just want to comment, and thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I do hope that we've done you a bit of justice by talking about it in kind of in a weird way between father and son. And the artwork, I'm assuming, is the responsibility of a daughter?
My daughter Caitlin did it. She's Jacob's age.
I love it.
Your turn. It was a digital, one of those digital tablets. So that was fun. It was a bit of a family affair. My kids have been my harshest critics, believe me. They give me some good advice. It was helpful. They always are, aren't they? Yeah. So yeah. That's who you need to get you writing better is teenagers. I didn't need to have professional editors. I needed my teenagers to tell me, kids don't talk like that. Oh, you're being ridiculous. Well, again.
Yeah. So Foster Boy is by William Taylor, and it's available on easyyoke.org.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon or Blackwells, so some independent. And when the bookshops open, you can order it from independent bookshops. But
imagine the day when that happens.
Yes, we look forward to that.
Rian, thank you so much for talking to us, and we really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks so much for Jacob's input. To be honest, it's been so lovely for me to talk with someone who I wrote that book for. So just to have more stories for, you know, all kids in a sense, but particularly for people who've been through the system to have a few varieties of stories beyond Tracy Beaker. Yeah. So it's really nice to meet you, Jacob. And I want you to write something. Yeah.
Thank you, Ryan, because it's great for me to be able to ask you questions to help me understand the book better.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a really great experience. So thank you.
Thanks, guys.